Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I've had one too many cigarettes, burning up my lungs. Had to taste of one too many lips, hanging off my tongue. Oh, oh, oh. Sunday morning, getting high, drinking here alone. Thinking up a brand new alibi for not coming home. Oh, oh.
Good and evil are not black and white. We all have a mix of naughty and nice. Poetry allows us to explore our dark sides and find our way to the light. I celebrate people who, like the founder of this show, recognize they are on a dangerous path and make the difficult adjustments to be an amazing person. Share poems that reveal the duality of our vulnerability and strength. Capture the internal battle of the demon and angel on your shoulders. Deep poetry, thoughtful commentary, and fun chatter for sinners, saints, and everyone in between. I am Brooke, as a host, or fabler, either is fine. My normal co-host, Ephesiana, is out this evening, so I believe I have Pam hanging out with me. Is that correct?
That is correct. Hello, babbler. How's it going?
Good. Busy. I am in my pre-audit crunch time, so I'm pulling 60-hour weeks till the end of the week. So I'm a little brain fried.
Wow. Yeah, that is busy. That definitely
yeah.
is busy.
How are you doing?
All in all, I'm doing pretty good. I'm trying to adjust to these warmer temperatures. We went from what felt like the winter that would never end to like today was 80 degrees. And
oh, wow.
I just don't do it. Yeah, it's a big jump. And for so I know for some people in some areas, 80 is actually not that hot, but for me it is, and I have a hard time adjusting to it. So, but other than that, you know, life is good. Just a nice, easy day today. Looks like you got a great lineup of poetry.
Yeah. Yeah, so I figure we'll do it kind of how we've been doing, if that works for you, Pam, if you don't mind posting the link as we go down, and we'll just alternate for reading and that kind of fun stuff.
All right.
The first ones I have up on the board are from their carryovers from my contest about purple or violet, your pick. That's the end, or is it, of the rainbow series that I've been doing, where I've gone through all the colors of the rainbow and just asked people to post what that makes them think of. For that contest, I had posted some prompts, so I'll go ahead and go over those just in case that's what somebody used to inspire them, so that it's not completely out of left field, like what are they talking about? But I did leave it fairly open-ended so that the prompts were really just meant to help along, but you were welcome to pick whatever you picked that inspired you by the color purple. So some of the prompts that I left were flower of this purple dye, hit with Cupid's archery, sink in the apple of his eye by William Shakespeare. And then the second prompt was a photo of lilacs by Mara Tyler. The third, I won't eat any cereal that doesn't turn the milk purple by Bill Watterson. The fourth prompt was a pop art piece by Enrico Moses of Prince, done entirely in shades of purple. The fifth was Stars Will Blossom in the Darkness, Violets Bloom Beneath the Snow by Julia Caroline Doerr. The sixth prompt was a picture of the Violet Crumble, which is a candy bar from Australia that is unlike anything else they've eaten, so it's hard to compare the flavor to anything. An interesting velvety texture too. Oh yeah, it's good. It's really good. But I really can't describe the taste because I've really not had anything else that tastes like that. It's a really interesting candy bar. Prompt 7. This is the violet hour, the hour of hush and wonder. When the affectations glow and valor is reborn, when the shadows deepen along the edge of the forest, and we believe that if we watch carefully, at any moment, we may see the unicorn, by Bernard DeVoto. So those are the prompts. So if anything, go ahead and get started.
All right. Well, up first we have Twilight by Phoenix Aradia, and go ahead, Babbler, and give that a read for us, please.
All righty. Twilight. Crepuscular animals rouse to their senses, stimulated by the gloaming light. As the dusk settles in, I stand in a doorway and welcome the approaching night. I'm caught in the fleeting moments between sun, moon, and star. None of them anywhere near me. All feel thrillingly not too far. Day passes her baton to the night, who swiftly falls to the ground. As the moon glows and stars appear, as the sun keeps going around. In those obscure hours of evening, both worlds seem to hold sway, and the creatures belonging to neither luxuriate in shades of gray. End poem. I like this piece. What did you think, Pam?
Oh, I thought this was absolutely a wonderful write. I really like how it pays tribute to twilight, the time of the day where there's such a sense of that in-betweenness, you know, and where there's that lingering color. And just amazing imagery throughout, beautifully written. I do particularly like that end stanza And also, I really like, I'm caught in the fleeting moments between sun, moon, and star. None of them are anywhere near me. All feel thrillingly not too far. And I like how that speaks on the idea that acknowledging that the stars aren't near you, but at the same time, in that moment, that you feel as if you could reach out and touch them. So beautifully written and very well done.
Yeah, I agree. Twilight is really my favorite time of day. I used to feel weird calling it dusk, because dusk, I don't know, it just sounds so harsh for that time of day. So I used to call it twilight, and then the Twilight series came out, and then I'm like, yeah, not that Twilight. So ever since, I've just been like, sunset? But it is my favorite time of day, and I know exactly the time that they're talking about. You know, the crepuscular animals, you know, those that only are there at sunset and sunrise times. That's when they're most active. Usually animals of prey, like rabbits and rodents and things like that, that are crepuscular. You know, with that gloaming light, the way everything glows and is thrown into relief, like everything in the foreground is in black. And the sky can be the most beautiful colors, and very often is like an indigo color or a purple color. It's everything feels energetic to me at that time of day. So I've always enjoyed it. I like the idea of day passing her baton to the night. I think is just a wonderful personification, and then he swiftly falls to the ground. So it's like not even like a good passing off. It's like a fumbled baton pass. You know, the day passes her baton to the night, and the night trips and falls, which I just enjoyed as an imagery. And I like the part too that you poked out as well there with the none of them are anywhere near me. All feel thrillingly not too far. And it is kind of boggling, right, to look up at the sky, and you see the stars, and you can see the planets, and you can see the moon, and they don't look that far away. But then when you conceptualize how far they really are, it's absolutely astounding, just really how far away they are. The fact that we can see it, you know, the fact that we can detect that light at all, you know, that there's nothing in space really to diffuse it, so you actually get to see it from unbelievable distances. It's just crazy. So I really liked that stanza as well. So I thought this was great. I also love the idea of luxuriate in shades of gray. You know, these animals that don't really live in the day and don't really live in the night. They live, but they are not active. You know, they live in the way that I'm alive when I'm sleeping. As luxuriating in shades of gray, I thought was a wonderful verb to choose there. So I really liked the word choice. I loved the flow, and then just the understanding of the time and that sensation, I think, is really well communicated here. So I liked it. Very well done. Thank you, Phoenix Arabia. What do we have up next, Dan?
All right. Up next, we have The Purple Blooms by BlueWrite 76. And it goes like this. Lamps always in hands sway as they pass even a bright day. Dark, unexpected grays might block their ways. Lightnings in their brain, storms on the nerves rain. Startling fires in a train, deers in seizure and pain. Brave soldiers of life fighting battles and strife. Life to them is not a game. Anxiety they vanquish and tame. Hours lost to sleep, breaks and falls to leap. Why be the question in prayers? Creation of nature, the vague answers. Yonder be their victory, unimitable courage, their story. Medicines by the Savior, not afford to be cavalier. sacrifices be the only answer, every day a challenging prayer, living tough all days through, fighting an unknown foe, enduring every stumble, rise in courage humble, conquering fears every lay, living and loving every day, each priceless bloom of a kind, flowers in a war zone mind. After dark night's wild thunder, appears God's garden's wonder. Purple be their color, I love their cheer. Myriad storms through the miles, yet affirm, yet armed with beautiful smiles. Keeping their best foot forward, travel ceaselessly onward. Their goals in earnest, through life's wild forest. Never resting the eyes, every smog they slice. Ministering kith and kin beside, give them both hope and aid. Their path is lit with love and grit. To God in prayer we bow our purple blooms now. Beyond the testing bend awaits the tunnel's end. End poem.
This is a really interesting rite. It says here in the footnote, that this is on epilepsy and courage of those who face it and overcome it with small daily victories. You know, these couplets about the struggles of people who are, you know, dealing with epilepsy. And this is epilepsy specifically, but it could be really anyone who suffers from seizures, you know, or anything that really takes someone out for a moment. You know, it could be even someone with, like, sciatica, you know. Who, despite these difficulties, despite, you know, the pains that they go through, still work every day to accomplish things, to enjoy life in the in-betweens, you know. I think that's beautifully communicated. I was very fascinated about the rhyming in this piece. You know, there's these couplets here that really appear to rhyme. You know, you got sway, day, graze, ways, brain, rain, train, pain. And most of them are pretty direct rhymes like this. And then you get to about victory and story and prayers and answers. It starts to fall apart a little bit. I don't know if that was intentional or not. Or maybe this is, it almost feels like if you followed English like you learned it phonetically and not as a native speaker, then these are words that might rhyme. You know, like they could be rhymes if English was remotely consistent about pronunciation, but it's not. So it doesn't, you know, like through and foe. You know, if you followed phonetic learning, you might read that as throw, and that could rhyme with bow, but it doesn't because English is a pain in the ass. there's a few, you know, like color and cheer, and I appreciate off rhymes, but I also kind of wonder if maybe it's intentional, you know, like to the stutter of kind of having an illness like this. You know, this kind of a disability where it's periodic and every once in a while throws you off. You know, if that's the case, that's very clever. You know, like color and cheer don't really rhyme. Eyes and slice. I just found it really fascinating. You know, like even when I read like beside and aid, like if you, again, were phonetic and English was remotely consistent, you could read that as eyed. And that would rhyme, but English is all over the place. So I found it really interesting, the rhyming, just how it periodically is like, oh, not now. And I almost wondered if that was symbolic of seizures themselves. So fascinating. I really enjoyed this blue rite. Thank you for the submission. And I obviously see how it's on topic as well. What did you think, Pam?
You know, I really appreciated this one. And yeah, I had the same thoughts, like that you brought up the rhyme. I had the same thoughts that the kind of glitch in the rhyme was perhaps a representation of the glitch that happens in the epileptic brain. So And of course, you know, most people know me, know that while I don't go around talking a whole bunch about it, that I am pretty open about the fact that I have epilepsy myself. And so I'm very appreciative of Blue Right 76 writing this. And because, you know, now I'm very fortunate. I actually haven't had a seizure in years because I'm fortunate to have had a conversation, not a conversation, gosh, sorry. And brain glitches is like that is what people with epilepsy deal with even after we have medication that controls the seizures. So I am lucky enough to be on medication that has controlled my seizures for years. But there, during my childhood and even up until my 20s, I was having, you know, anywhere from multiple seizures a week. And I know there are people who suffer from it, who suffer from multiple seizures per day. You know, and then, of course, there's the other stuff that goes with epilepsy, like you're more prone to depression, you're more prone to, you know, ADHD, you know, all kinds of different. It's not just the seizures themselves, although that's obviously a very main part of it. And, you know, I don't want to go on too long about it, but I just wanted to express, of course, that for obvious personal reasons, and my father had epilepsy, one of his cousins did, my sister has it, you know, but there is help out there, but unfortunately not everyone is fortunate enough to be able to find the right kind of medication or have access to the medication that will control their seizures. But I like the imagery in this, I like the couplets, I like the kind of, I like the mention of the purple with the thought being that, you know, that's the purple ribbon that represents National Epilepsy Awareness, which if I remember right, Epilepsy Awareness Month is in October, but don't quote me on that because poor memory skills is also a thing that us people with epilepsy deal with. Either because of the seizures or because of the huge amounts of medication we have to be on to control them. I really, really liked especially lightnings in their brain, storms on the nerves, rain, because that's actually one of the best ways to describe a seizure to people who don't understand it, is it's basically like all of a sudden, all those electrical signals that your brain is sending throughout to your body get all screwed up, just start flashing and sparking everywhere, setting off the storm, and your body says, I don't know what the fuck to do now, so I'm just going to drop, freeze, and start shaking because you are sending way too many messages to me. But definitely an excellent write and very well done.
Thanks for sharing that, Dan. Yeah. I didn't know that about you. I hadn't heard you talk about that.
Okay. Well, I don't talk about a whole lot. You know, usually I only bring it up if it's somehow applicable. But for the most part, I'm not one to, you know, jump around going, I have epilepsy. So, you know.
That, you know, it's not like you start conversations with like, hi, I'm Brooke and I have bipolar. Like, that's not
right, exactly.
There's a lot of other things about her that you know besides that.
Yeah.
Not that I feel bad about that. I, you know, I don't necessarily feel shame just because I don't really let other people stigmatize me, you know. But it's not, you know, I'm not wearing a sign around, you know.
Right. Exactly. There's so many other things that we would like to be judged for. Like, you know, I don't know, for me, I would say it's my poor taste in clothing rather than having epilepsy, you know?
Yeah. Like, it's cool. No. So what people's opinions of me are, because depending on, like, when in my, like, range of mental states you met me, like, you may have completely different outlooks than, like, who I am as a person.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
All right. I put up the next link just because I figured you were talking, so I'd do the favor.
Awesome.
And it's my piece, because I wrote one to my own prompt. I do that sometimes. So this is Rooted. It goes like this. These are the dregs, little runny bits at the bottom of the bowl, clinging on, refusing to be incorporated, defaulted to drain water, rinsed away into nothinghood. Molecules available for some other use, hitching a ride on the back of indecision. Flipping through the catalog, mulling each option until violet slips between my fingers, fading to black. Defined by Newton's first law of just fucking do it already. Rock steady, still unmoved, without the benefit of the longevity of granite. The world moves around me, not as a center or a crux, but as a whitewater obstacle waiting to catch and pull down any wayward rafter who didn't steer clear of this black hole friendship, loosely garbed in nihilism. Drowning while fish swim in and out to sea. Neither water nor riverbed, a noisome stone. Light meanders through the ripples, losing wavelengths as the river sips sunlight cocktails of color. Dancing streaks of lilac bloom through May. And I'm here, the February root mass, destined for darkness, siphoning from the mother soil daydreams buried in deep purple. A meristem, capable of anything other than making up my mind, catching bits of cake batter, never fully baked. End poem.
Wonderful reading right there, Babbler. Yeah, I can see why you were inspired by those prompts. I kind of wish I had noticed that because purple is definitely one of my favorite colors. But I like that you've captured, there's a certain diversity to the color purple and all that it represents. And to me, I like that you chose the prompt. At least it seems to me, I'm guessing, you chose to write on the prompt about twilight, because it has that feel to it. Let's see here. Violet slips between my fingers, fading to black, defined by Newton's first law of just fucking do it already. Rock steady, still unmoved, without the benefit of the longevity of granite, the world moves around me, not as a center or crux, but as a white water obstacle waiting to catch and pull down. I like how the just fucking do it already speaks to me on the idea of procrastination. And it also is one of the parts that makes me think of the idea of being at the end of the day, but not quite nighttime, because you're at the end of the day, you feel like you shouldn't have to do anything else, but you know there are things to get done and you've been putting them off all day. I also really like neither water nor riverbed, a noisome stone, light meanders through the ripples, losing wavelengths as the river sips sunlight cocktails of color. Sunlight cocktails of color. That's like a beautiful line, because it really does make you think of the whole idea of those umbrella type cocktails that have all the pretty colors in them. It feels like it's a representation also with the mention of the dregs of those kind of times in life where you feel like you're sinking rather than swimming. And even then the catching bits of cake batter never fully baked. That idea of like life doesn't feel done yet, and somehow it just keeps coming to to a close. You know, just brilliant, hard-hitting lines. I like how you write it straight, you know, like instead of separating the stanzas, it's just almost like this, like an organized flow of consciousness all the way through. But a beautiful look at the unexpected of life and trying to figure it all out. So very well done.
I mean, it really kind of was a stream of consciousness, right? I think I wrote this out in probably about 15 minutes. I talked to a few of the different prompts in here, but yeah, Twilight was definitely at the heart of it, you know, the end of something, you know, the dregs. Yeah, and not doing what you should. Yeah, that defined by Newton's first law of just fucking do it already. Yeah, you put something off all day long and you're like, why haven't I just done it? especially when it's something
right?
so easy and you know that it's easy and you just can't seem to get yourself to just do it. Yeah, and you're like, well, the day's almost over now, and I still haven't done that thing. Whatever it is.
Yep.
I need to fold the laundry. Nope, not folding the laundry. Or even at work, you know, I'm working and I need to send an email, and I've done, like, everything except send the email. I'm like, why? Why can't I just type up this email? It'll take 5 minutes if I just do it.
I really get that. Sometimes I use the end of the day as my excuse. I'm like, well, it's the end of the day. Too late now.
Right. Yeah. I've also done that. I guess it's tomorrow's thing now. yeah. Anyway, I'm glad you appreciated it. Yeah, I've also a little cut. I don't know. This is just a weird stream of thought I've had.
Very cool. I like it. All right. Well, up next we have Outdoor Ink Stains by Seagull. The mulberry tree outdid itself this year, perhaps in appreciation for the pruning last fall. Squirrels and blue jays squabble over the bounty, though there's plenty enough to share. The grandchildren run in. Purple fingerprints mark the newly printed screen door. What have you been up to this morning, I ask. Oh, nothing much, they say, through mulberry-stained lips. End poem.
Great read, Pam. And I really like this piece. It's such a wonderful little slice of life. You know, looking out at this mulberry tree that outdid itself. You know, you pruned it, or something, or it just got the right amount of sun, or something just made it super productive. And the squirrels are enjoying it, and the blue jays are enjoying it, but there's still just so many berries. And then there's the grandchildren, who are also apparently enjoying it. and it's cute, because, you know, the what have you been up to this morning? And the, oh, nothing much. Which isn't even necessarily wrong, you know, it's not like that's a lie, because out picking blueberries and munching on them isn't really, you know, it's hard to say what you define as much, right? But it's fun, and it almost feels like a little bit of a fib. It makes me think of my little sister, who is, like, the worst liar on the face of the planet, and how so many times she would be caught red-handed and still lie about things. And it's just, why are you lying? You know, there were times where my mom made a chocolate cake for my brother's birthday, and she totally ate it. She totally got into it. She had chocolate all over her face and in her mouth and everything else. So my mom was like, did you eat the cake? And she's like, no. And she's like, what do you have all over your face then? And she's like, I don't know. I was like, well, it's brown. And she was like, it's poop. And she was very insistent on the fact that it's poop. Even though clearly, like, it's chocolate cake, like we all know. What if we believed you and actually thought you were eating poop? Like, I didn't feel like concerned. But, She was notoriously bad at that kind of stuff, and she would lie even when there was no reason to lie. But it kind of reminds me of that, the, oh, nothing much, is like they're trying to hide the fact that they're eating the mulberries, even though there's nothing really, I don't think, wrong. You know, I don't think grandma or grandpa here is going to be, you know, mad about the feast on the mulberry tree. In fact, they've been enjoying the show. So I loved this. I thought it was a wonderful little slice of life, a little moment that kind of prods itself into memory for its simplicity and the small joy of it, and that mulberry color staining everything. I really liked it. I thought it was well done. What did you think, Pam?
Yeah, this is absolutely beautiful. It is, like you said, a nice little slice of life, and it makes you think of all those mischievous moments of, you know, when kids try to get away with things. I think for me, the funniest moment I ever had with one of my kids was my oldest was trying to sneak a pen upstairs. And I don't know why she wanted a pen, probably to draw on a wall. But you know how when, like, people, like, you see in movies or, you know, people, like, they hold something behind their back and then they walk on their tiptoes like they're being all sneaky. Well, she was doing that, which would have been a big enough clue, except for she was doing it while facing forward, so I could see her holding the pen behind her back. So definitely not her sneakiest moment, but you know, all the way through, all three stanzas of this is wonderful because each one touches on such an important, like, statement. Like, the, you know, on the first one we have the pruning mention, which is very true that you definitely you want a fruit tree, or you know, like we used to have raspberry bushes. And they weren't growing good anymore, so, you know, you had pruned them. You just, pruning is so important. And, of course, the last stanza with the oh, nothing much, through mulberry-stained lips is just delightful and very relatable. And I also like how in the second stanza, she's really captured the personality of squirrels and blue jays, because they definitely are very prone to squabbling. So excellent write.
Yeah, they are both prone to squabbling. I've been attacked by jays. I've not been attacked by squirrels, which is good. And I suppose that's probably why I like squirrels a little more than I like jays.
Yeah. I get that. Now, blue jays are beautiful, but they're like the freaking bullies of birds.
Yeah.
You know?
They're gorgeous, but they're mean.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Beautiful.
Ah,
very
right.
Angry about it.
Yeah, that's true.
There we
are. That's true. And up next we have Beds of Iris by Hoff. And go ahead, babbler.
All right. Beds of Iris. Swinging is better than living in the gutter, is what my grandmother was told when she was being sold at the local bar by her mother. She bloomed under a flowers regime, and it devoured her power to scream. Do what you have to do to get a pot of beans, is what my grandmother had heard as men tugged at her gird, and she was not quite yet a preteen. Soured by acid showers, her stems and leaves of tender green. When you're drinking, a lot of things happen, is what my grandmother had said as she spun her story's thread, a tale she's still trapped in. I wonder what they'd spoken of together, grandmother and a man now dead, married after they'd bred, as both would still screw whoever. We laid in beds of iris, she and all her likeness. The flower mimics a virus and spreads like a cancer inside us. End poem.
Wow. Oh my goodness, that one hits really hard, doesn't it? It's just a powerful reminder on the fact that, you know, that of the idea of that generational curse, or the idea of, you know, being passed of trauma being passed down from one generation to the next. I thought this was a great rhyming poem with the idea of I like how she has that one couplet thrown in there almost as if to really make that particular line stand out. She gloomed under a flower's regime, and it devoured her power to scream. You know, and what a sad thing. I mean, it truly is sad to think of a mother desperate enough to sell her child to anyone willing to pay. How she opens up with the lines with her swinging is better than living in the gutter is what my grandmother was told when she was being sold at the local bar by her mother. And, you know, to be so desperate, you know, that, you know, and I can't, you know, you can't imagine it. You just can't imagine being willing to sell off your own child. At least I can't, but I also have never been in that situation. So thank goodness. But I like how she speaks on the, where she says, we lay in beds of iris, she and all her likeness, the flower mimics a virus and spreads like a cancer inside us. Sometimes, you know, it's difficult because you can imagine this woman who, this young lady who grew up and eventually married this guy that, you know, but both of them still continued to sleep with other people, and there was never this real sense of trust, and that kind of, that lack of trust, that lack of understanding of human decency being passed down from generation to generation. And I like how the author speaks on gives her voice to, I still wonder what they'd spoken of together, grandmother and a man now dead, married after they bred, as both would still screw whoever. And I think, you know, that's one of those things that we do kind of wonder, you know, the what happened and why did it happen. And, you know, it's like, my grandmother, my mom's side, grew up in an abusive family with a brother who had psychological problems even before, but especially after he got back from World War II. And then she married a man who abused my mother. And it basically, then, you know, like there was just like each generation there seemed to be some sort of abuse that happened or that was ignored. Oftentimes it seems like there's this cycle of, especially there was this time period where it seemed like where women, because they didn't have a voice of their own or because it wasn't easy for them to find freedom, they often had to accept the abuse that happened to them or to even their children. And, you know, so it just puts a whole lot of thoughts in my head about the sadness of not only this individual family, the family that Hosk writes about, but the sadness of all families that have to go through that from one generation to the next. So just a powerful write and very well done.
A wonderful comment, Pam. It really is, it does really smack loudly of that generational trauma and generational pain and the way that someone went through something and it affects, you know, daughters or, you know, any children, really. You know, for me, I wonder, there are a few little things, like where I read Bloomed Under a Flower's Regime, I wonder, you know, if that's a reference to a particular you know, government or era that, you know, maybe I'm not quite picking up on. But, you know, at least, you know, I'm thinking this is a grandmother, you know, and it wasn't that long ago that women really, you know, you couldn't even have your own bank account. Like, I laugh sometimes because people talk about the divorce rate, you know, and my day, you know, you fixed it if it was broken. Did you? Or is divorce rate higher because women aren't, like, property of men these days? You know, and I think sometimes it's forgotten. Humans have such a short memory and such a short attention span. You know, I'm not talking about something that is ages ago. I think it was, like, in 1970s, maybe late 60s, when women could have their own bank accounts. That is not that long ago. Like, that is really not that long ago. You know, those women are still alive. Those are grandmas. And I think it was, like, 1994 when it was finally made illegal that, like, you can't rape your wife is now illegal. 1994. Like,
that's insane.
Yeah, that's just not that long ago. Like, that's so recent. And that's what this makes me think of. You know, you've got this poor woman here who was sold, essentially, by her mother, and was told, like, this is better than being homeless. That's debatable. You know, and to feel useless, you know, like, you have to do what you can to put food in your mouth. Even when you're not even a teenager, like, you're a kid, you know, and you're basically being sex trafficked by your own parents as a child to pedophiles, you know, and you spin these stories in your head to justify these things, to rationalize them, to make it seem like, oh, it's not that bad. You know, when you're drinking, a lot of things happen, like, you know, hey, you know, behavior, drinking is a choice, so you're not excused for your poor behavior. I think poor behavior is really mild for what we're talking about. And to have lived married to this man, that you're only really married to them because you had children, you know, married after they'd bred. Like, oh, I'm pregnant, so I guess we have to get married now. And clearly they weren't super in love with each other because they just screw whoever. I'm not getting the painted picture of, like, the happy swingers with the open marriage, okay? This is,
right.
Okay, we're married, but I'm still going to go F around. Like, it's not, you know, we're not talking about the people who put the pineapples outside and invite the neighbors over for fun times. That's not what we're talking about. you know, and so, you know, we lay in bed of Iris, and she and all her likeness, the flower mimics the virus and spreads like cancer inside us. You know, it's generational pain because this woman was married to this piece of shit, and that piece of shit was her kid's dad. You know, that's going to lay scars. That's going to carry on pain. And clearly here we're looking at the grandchild who's now looking back at this story and being like, wow, this is really messed up, and this is where I came from. You know, this poor woman named Iris. It also says here in the footnote, my great-grandmother's name is Iris, which almost makes me wonder, are we talking Great Depression? You know, great-grandmother, I think, would put you right about that era, probably. You know, and so dealing
yeah,
with,
I think you're right.
You know, the times and trials of that era. So, this is a beautiful, hard-hitting piece. It's really dark. It's really gritty, but it feels really real, you know, the uglier side of life. And yet there's still love here. I'm not talking this woman, her quote-unquote husband, a.k.a. owner. I'm talking between, you know, the child to the grandmother. You know, there's empathy here. There's shared pain here. And there's love in that way. And it feels really real and emotional because of that. I'm also love the commitment to this rhyme scheme. I feel like it's really well done, this, you know, ABBA in the four line stanzas is really well done as well. I really enjoyed it. I thought this was an excellent, excellent write. So thank you so much, Osk, for the submission and the permission to read the piece. I really liked it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So tell me, how long has that whole pineapple thing for swingers been a thing? Because I only just recently learned about this.
Oh,
and
know,
I have to admit, that, is this like fairly new?
I'm not totally sure. You know, like, I have no idea when that came about. I've known about it for quite a while, but I don't know when it became a thing.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure. I only know about it because when I was in, like, maybe my mid-20s, I bought a shirt at a thrift store that had an upside-down pineapple on it, and I was quickly informed that I was putting out messages that I probably don't mean. And I was like, oh, I just thought the shirt looked cool.
Oh, my gosh. That is...
So I have no idea when it really became a thing because I don't know. But I certainly...
Yeah.
I heard about it quite a few years ago when... Like I said, I purchased a shirt and I was quickly informed that I was sending some signals.
I just think there must be a more subtle way to let people know you're a swinger, but I suppose not really. The only thing we get put out on porches are jack-o'-lanterns and squashes during the fall.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I have no idea when it came to be a thing. I don't know. Although I did have a friend who bought a house not too long ago, and she bought this really nice brand new house just down the street from me, and she did her entire living room in like this beautiful aqua color and pineapples, and I was just like,
wow.
Trying to tell me something, and she's like, what do you need? And I'm like, I told her about the pineapple thing, and she was like, oh my god, no.
Oh, that is too funny.
You really
did she leave
this
it?
Because
oh, that's
funny.
Oh,
I go to her all the time. Every time she's like, oh, I need to go to the store. I'm like, picking up a pineapple? It's just a joke.
That's me. All right. Well, up next we have Calvin and Hobbes surrounded by evil animated zombie snowmen by Weaver of Dreams. Calvin, having eaten breakfast, now has a mainly purple visage. In his opinion, there's no merit in cereal with no underlying pizzazz. Calvin looks out of the window where snow lies deeply on the lawn. Zombie snowmen have been very busy, multiplying before dawn. His house is fully surrounded, no matter. There'll be no school today, he knows. All the teachers will already be frozen as snowman zombies attack in droves. Used to combat, Calvin is unfazed, but this army of unholy undead, he and Hobbes know the best idea is to knock them off every zombie's head. Out they creep down the yard, then back to back our stalwarts stand, quickly making huge snowballs, willing to freeze to protect their land. Dad sees him wrestling with the snowman, watched by Hobbes on that gloomy gray day. Remembering his own childhood, he smiles, knowing he'll rescue him, only not right away. End poem.
Wonderful read, Pam. And another great slice of life, right? Obviously, this is the Bill Watterson quote inspiration about not eating cereal that doesn't leave purple in the bowl. But I love where it went with the snowmen. When he got to the stanza about used to combat, Calvin is unfazed by this army of unholy undead. He and Hobbes know the best idea is to knock off every zombie's head. I picture, you know, those kids who, little hooligans that go around and knock the snowmen down, like, out of everyone's yard. Which always sounds kind of funny, because, you know, some kids get really upset, cry about it, and they worked hard to make their snowman or whatever, and they've got these destructive, you know, kids around there beating the snowmen up. But it never bothered me, because it was just, they're just having fun. It's utterly harmless, like it's a snowman. It was going to be gone in not long anyway. But it just made me think of them, you know, out they creep down the yard, and then back to back our stalwarts stand, just fighting this horde of snowmen by knocking their heads off. I just thought it was a really fun painting of a winter's day. The idea of, like, saving your school teachers and they're frozen. He's been attacked by the snow zombies. You know, it's a fun story. And then again, you've got this perspective of Dad watching and remembering the way he used to play with snowmen as well. So it's nice. It's a nice little tale. No, I liked it. It was fun. It was playful. It had a great rhyme to it. Wonderful flow. So well done, Weaver. Pam, what did you think?
I liked this. It did have a great rhyme and flow. I like that she wrote about Calvin and Hobbes, because there's something just so fun and innocent about that particular character, the little boy in his imaginary tiger. It did have great rhyme and flow, fun imagery, I like the humor in this, you know, especially, you know, used to combat, Calvin is unfazed by the army of unholy undead. He and Hobbes know the best idea is to knock off every zombie's head. And then another particularly good part was the end where he brings in the dad. Dad sees him wrestling with the snowman, watched by Hobbes on that gloomy gray day. Remembering his own childhood, he smiles, knowing he'll rescue him, only not right away. That whole idea of being that cool enough of a dad to just stand back and wait and let them have their fun and then rescue them when it's time. So definitely a clever and fun write and very well done.
Agreed. Very nostalgic if you've been there.
Absolutely. All-time favorite winter activity, building snowmen.
Mm-hmm. Where are we off to?
All right. Up next, we have Purple by Chris Bond. And go ahead and give that a read there, Babbler.
Alrighty. Purple heart, purple haze, purple rain, raspberry beret, once rich in nobility's color. End poem.
Wow. You might need a drink of water after reading that long one. That was quite the brevity. But I'm sorry. Did you want me to continue commenting? I kind of just spoke up there.
No worries.
All right. But actually, I will say that for a brevity, it says quite a bit, because it really gives a nod towards some of the most infamous things when it comes to the color purple. The Purple Heart, of course, being awarded for bravery, the Purple Haze, Jimi Hendrix, Purple Rain, and Raspberry Beret, both songs by Prince. And I did like the end line, I mean, with Once Rich in Nobility's Color, and because that's actually fascinating. It was fascinating to me because it actually became a color for royalty and people who are extremely rich, because in order to get the color purple, it was originally like there were these shells, snails or shells or bugs or something. There was something that they had to gather and crush in order to make the color purple. And it was so expensive to do it that only nobility and the extremely well off could afford to wear purple. And so just a wonderfully written brevity by Chris Bond.
Yeah, I believe it was a snail. This really weird spiky snail, too, was the only place that you could get the color purple. And you had to collect them from the snails, and you had to collect them by the thousands. I believe the color is called Tyrian purple. And the reason I remember that is because I was reading about this at the same time that Game of Thrones was playing. I remember thinking about the character Tyrion and if that name was related at all. but yeah, it's fascinating how the color purple is royal purple, because it was a symbol of wealth. I remember reading, too, that in the South, sweet tea was similar. It used to be a symbol of wealth, a kind of stuck-up symbol of wealth, because tea was incredibly expensive. I mean, hence the Boston Tea Party and part of the Revolution, is it was really difficult. You had to import it all the way from Asia, which was really expensive to do. Another thing that was really expensive was sugar. Sugar was also a luxury item. And ice in the South was incredibly hard to come by, especially in the summer. So sweet tea was kind of a we're rich kind of drink. You had to sit out there with a pitcher of tea in the South. Obviously before the advent of, like, freezers and more, you know, streamlined world trade, but it used to be a real kind of class delineating beverage that I kind of equate in my mind to the color purple. And, you know, I like this as a brevity. Obviously, this is, like, what comes to mind when you think of purple. I do like that it went into raspberry beret, because then it's kind of almost like an off purple. I feel like they almost got sidetracked by their own thoughts. Like, oh, a purple heart makes me think of purple haze, and purple haze makes me think of purple rain. And if I think of purple rain, then I think of raspberry beret, because Prince sang them both. Once rich and nobility's color. I thought this was a great little brevity. It was like the iconic moment in the history of purple. So. Lovely bite. That was
I like that.
Carryover. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I like that you brought up that it almost like the switch to raspberry beret was like they got sidetracked by their own thoughts. That was cool.
It's just relatable. Wait, where am I going? Read my website. I think that was the last one in the carryovers from the purple contest, violet contest, whatever you wanted to call it, which brings me to the next contest that I did, which was actually the second part in my poetry and translation series that I was doing, which was a continuation of my rumination on translated poetry. It occurred to me a while ago that poetry shifts when it crosses language barriers because there's so many aspects that can get lost or jostled in translations. You can lose metaphors, idioms, rhyming, double meanings, and cultural context. By no means am I claiming this is an original thought. I'm sure a lot of people have had it, but it was a new one for me. And so every time I read one translated poem, I think about what little bits and pieces maybe I'm missing. You know, because language doesn't work one-to-one. You know, like you've got Eskimos that have like 30-some words for snow. You know, and for us, we just have the word snow with a bunch of adjectives. you know, and it's hard to keep that because poems are such a mix of, like, word meaning and cadence and sound. that you're really going to kind of, it's not going to look the same. And then because it went through someone else's eyes, it's also translational. So you're getting an interpretation of a piece. So it's like art upon art. And yet I still feel like it's worth attempting to cross the bridge. I think there's a whole wealth of expression and ideas that we can expose ourselves to and broaden our experience with people, see things through other cultural perspectives. So in the series, I was focusing on ancient poets, Asian poets, sorry, with a focus on one at a time. So for this series, I highlighted the poet Murasaki Shikibu. And Murasaki is the pen name of a Japanese novelist, poet, and lady-in-waiting in the imperial court of the Heian period of Japan. She's known best as the author of The Tale of Genji, which is widely considered to be one of the world's first novels, which was written in Japanese about around 1000 to 1012 AD. True identity is unknown, though there's a lot of speculation. But outside of her work as a novelist, she also published a collection of 128 largely biographical poems called Poetic Memoirs. The original set's been lost, but there have been a lot of translations of the piece that have been kept. So they've been passed person to person and often copied. Some of the poems seem to be written for a lover, possibly her husband before she died. But she could just be following tradition and writing simple love poems. So for this contest, I posted three different poems of hers that obviously have been translated because that's all we have for translations. So these were meant to inspire. For the first quote or poem, some of Murasaki's poems are written as communications that have a question and a response or go between to parties. So these are examples of that. Frosted by stiff ice, my writing brush cannot begin to draw you a picture of my feelings. And then the response, though it flows not, continue to write. Your pain will float away like frost and ice on the water. For the second piece, my place in the world. Why should it bring me grief? Mountain cherry, blossom in my sight, were it ever so. And then for the third one, may that lady live 1,000 years who guards the flowers. My sleeves are wet with thankful tears, as though I had been working in a garden of dewy chrysanthemums. And that one was translated by Annie Shepley Omori and Kochi Doi. So that was the inspiration for this contest.
Very cool. Yes, our first poem is Where the Cherry Blossoms Grow by Dammit Dave. I travel through this world to find a place where grief is but a distant hazy dream, where teardrops never fall upon my face and sorrows float away upon a stream. I travel where the cherry blossoms grow to fill my eyes with everlasting light, where inner peace is always status quo, and sun and moon are always shining bright. I know someday that I am gonna find the destination I am searching for, and finally I'll have some peace of mind and know serenity forevermore. End poem.
Excellent read, Pam. And wonderful write, Dave. As usual, your rhyme and flow are just always so right on point. Something I really appreciate about your poetry, and it works so beautifully here. I love how you took her poem about my place in the world and really kind of added to the journey and kind of made it your own. I can definitely see the inspiration from Murasaki in here. It travels through this world to find a place where grief is but a distant, hazy dream, where teardrops never fall upon my face and sorrows float away upon a stream. That bottom part, that the second, the two bottom lines of that stanza almost make me think of the third that talks about gardening and the dewy chrysanthemums. So clearly, you know, it's a metaphor for crying. And I think this kind of plays upon that beautifully. You know, I travel where the cherry blossoms grow to fill my eyes with everlasting light, where inner peace is always status quo and sun and moon are always shining bright. To me, that almost seems like a play on the idea of nirvana or something like that, like a spiritual awakening, because, you know, where cherry blossoms glow with everlasting light, so it's always spring, you know, and where inner peace is status quo and the sun and moon are always shining bright. You know, you don't usually have both the sun and the moon shining bright at the same time. You usually have one or other. I mean, sometimes you get both. I mean, there's certainly times I look up in the sky and I'm like, there's the moon in its daytime. But that's atypical. And so to see all of those things at once, you know, to be in that kind of place is kind of surreal, you know. It's kind of like about finding happiness, about finding something that feels mythological, you know, something seems really slim and unlikely. And then, you know, I know someday that I'm going to find the destination that I'm searching for, and finally I'll have some peace of mind and no serenity forevermore. You know, it being permanent, you know, it almost feels like an afterlife. You know, like one day I'll die and be at peace, you know, or at least like a really deep meditation. And yet there's nothing like threatening or scary about this at all. You know, it feels like a natural progression, you know, with the idea of heaven or afterlife being this place where cherry blossoms grow and you feel a sense of inner peace. It's a very beautiful rite. I love it. It's it feels almost meditational. So I really enjoyed it. Thank you, Dave. Pam, what did you think?
Yeah, this is a beautiful take off of the chosen prompt and absolutely great spot on metered rhyme and flow. I really like this all the way through. It's beautifully written, and it does have that kind of meditative spiritual feeling of that search for nirvana. My favorite stanza is that second one. I travel where the cherry blossoms grow to fill my eyes with everlasting light, where inner peace is always status quo and sun and moon are always shining bright. I like where the use of the phrase status quo, you know, the idea that it's not something far-fetched to have inner peace. And I like the idea of the sun and moon are always shining bright, because it's the idea of finding, to me anyways, that inner light that within yourself. So excellent write and very well done.
Thank you very much. What have we got up next?
All right, let's see here. All right, up next we have Poetic Prince Penner Pal by Jenny Hunt, 2017. And go ahead, Babbler.
Right. Poetic Prince Penner Pal. Cotton candy, bubblegum swirl, acid raindrops. Entering piracy, penning poacher brains. Never taking accountability. Works from the heart they steal. Two. Poetic Prince Eskimo of late night. Enlightening others to do what's right. Not being heard or seen, they ignore him. Naive little poetess, too nice with digressions. Inspiring one is flattery indeed. Not giving credit where credit is due. Giving innocent artists the wrong impression. Three. Here in my head filled with dread, entered a stranger turned new acquaintance. Rendered speechless at his heroism. Open feelings for future friendships and inspiration. End poem.
Yeah, this is wonderful. I see it's a tribute that she wrote to a couple of poets, Ben Hart and Eski. I think that's wonderful. It's a great take off of the prompt and a wonderful write on being thankful. Great stanzas and lines all the way through, some wonderful use of imagery and alliteration, especially in that beginning stanza, blue cotton candy, bubblegum swirl, acid rain drips. And then I like it all the way through, but another part I really like is that third section with "Here my head filled with dread entered a stranger new turned new acquaintance rendered speechless at his heroism opening feelings for future friendships and inspiration." And I think that's a wonderful thing to meet somebody who, you know, steps up for you, becomes a hero, and has the potential to become a future friendship. So wonderful write and very well done.
Yeah, I love the direction that this took, you know, to be inspired by others, you know, give a nod to the other poets. I love the way this opens. It feels so wild and trippy, you know, blue cotton candy bubblegum swirl acid raindrops. Like, what a wild time. That reminds me of my favorite candy when I was a kid, which was called Atomic Warheads. And they had, like, this coating on them that was, like, incredibly sour and bitter. It would just make my lips pucker. But there's something about that bitter flavor that makes me salivate. that's probably my Norwegian heritage or something. And then I get through it and get to the sweet. But this wild, like, acid raindrops, you know, blue cotton candy, bubblegum swirl, acid raindrops. Makes me think of all of that, the tart and the sweet and the candiness of it. And then that next line, entering piracy, penning poacher brains, never taking accountability, works from the heart, they feel. You know, to be inspired by others, but not always give nods to them, not always give them credit. You know, to kind of read someone else's work and be like, oh, I can relate to this and kind of piggyback off it. But you don't always give credit for that, you know, your sources of inspiration. So then take this as an opportunity to do that, you know, poetic Prince Eskimo of late night being a nod, you know, to Eski, and the way that, you know, you've been inspired by them. Inspiring one is flattery indeed. Not giving credit where credit is due gives innocent artists the wrong impressions. You know, to think you're doing it all on your own, to think, you know, your ideas don't come from someone else, and to give that credit, I think is really great. You know, and then here in my head filled with dread, entered a stranger, turned new acquaintance, rendered speechless at his heroism. Opening feelings for future friendships and inspirations, you know, to then welcome them as a friend, you know, to be inspired by them and not say anything, and then to say something, and then to be like, and we can be friends, you know, to reach out and make that connection. You know, sometimes you never know, right? I don't know who all has read my poetry and been inspired to write something by it. Occasionally I have someone tell me or tag me or include my handle in their poem, but unless they directly point it out like that, I'd have no idea, you know. And it's nice sometimes to get that nod, so I appreciate that Jenny here is giving that nod, and even to Ben Hart, who's mentioned in the footnote, you know, to give that credit of inspiring someone, which can really mean a lot. So I really enjoyed this piece of gratitude. I can see how it relates to the prompts. So I thought this was wonderfully done. Thank you, Jenny. Where are we off to?
There we go. All right. Up next, we have Purple Monkey Dishwasher by Daniel Dischino. And it goes like this. Part one, communication breakdown. The mind is a strobe light in front of a pastel-colored horse carousel within a fog-prisoned circus. Many days I feel like a lone equestrian. Sometimes I wave and smile as the ones that know me best grab a quick picture. How happy am I when that picture develops clear? Part two, blissful ignorance. On a beautiful, warm summer's day, on a scheduled escape from the world, the early morning sunrise offers the simple peace and contented loneliness, and with worries forgotten in the air that is seemingly for my breath alone, I shelter a mountain and backdrop to purify the mind. I sit with books and nothing else, and they were other breaths I've taken before the mountain CPR, all of them catalysts for the input that has become me, and that me as the interpreter of all things reads, and I relate and contemplate, fantasize and theorize at the carnival pamphlet I hold in my hand of whips and reins, reading words of muted kaleidoscope lights from equestrian ghosts, part three, lost in translation. In a town off of a highway exit less noticeable than the trees that surround it, on a street, off a street, off a street, in a small, dull, tucked away store run by the daughter of the original owner, on a small shelf on the back corner, among the other dust-covered books, there is a dictionary from 1830, missing all the words on my cell phone and without the word cell phone in it. And it passes its days leaning on a once only read story of Gilgamesh, translated, bound, annotated, prefaced, and indexed. And my mind travels into cinematic dreams of a time-traveling Gilgamesh. He picks up the book, wondering who the story is about. He theorizes with Imhotep on plagiarizing architecture, and they both laugh with Maid Marian as she tickles them with tales of saving Robin Hood once again. And I scroll through Instagram to watch a video of a United States president speaking with digitally altered mouth and edited enhanced words and poem.
I really liked this piece. It felt a little more inspired by the concept of the series rather than the poems, but I didn't mind that. You know, I felt like it started off in a way with that natural tie to it, about sinking into nature, you know, to enjoy a moment. You know, communication breakdown. Mine is a strobe light in front of a pastel-colored horse carousel within a fog prison circuit. Well, that sounds chaotic. You know, it sounds almost like a horror movie, really. You know, to have this fog wrapped around a carousel that's then wrapped in a strobe light, you know. Many days I feel like a lone equestrian, the only person on there, you know, riding all these horses, you know, and the people that know you best will grab a quick picture of how happy you are when the picture develops clear. So even with all this chaos and in a scenario that I would find less than pleasing, you know, they're still happy. So I found that really interesting, imagery-wise. And then in part two, blissful ignorance, you know, they talk about just enjoying the moment of nature, you know, offers the simple peace of contented loneliness with worries forgotten in the air, the seemingly for my breath alone, you know, that quiet moment where you can just be at peace with yourself and there's no one to talk to and there's nothing to do that's urgent and you can sit. You know, I sit with a book and nothing else. And so there's this reading and kind of sinking into this moment. I love the term mountain CPR because it feels that way sometimes, right? You get so lost in the hustle and bustle of daily life. And then when you go out camping or even just sit on your porch and just observe the natural world, it does just feel like that breath of fresh air. And the idea of that as CPR I thought was really clever. All of them catalysts. The input that has become me, which makes me think again to the part one where everything's kind of chaotic, you know, and I think of that as like the inner turnings of the mind and all the places things take you, you know, and that me as the interpreter of all things reads, and I relate and contemplate, and, you know, all these chaotic things that they do with the input, you know. Your input is calm, you're reading, you're enjoying the moment, but at the same time, like, the brain is firing, you know, chaotically. Reading words muted, kaleidoscope-like, from equestrian ghosts. I think the wording there is beautiful, and the way to have it, like, both be calm and chaotic at the same time, I think is really fascinating. And then part three, lost in translation. You know, I love the description. In a town off a highway exit, less noticeable than the trees around it. I live in a really woodsy area, and so sometimes the exits really do kind of creep up on you like that. There's lots of big trees and everything, and all of a sudden there's a sign that's like, exit here, and you can almost miss it. On a street, off a street, off a street. Wow, there's some directions. But it's true, right? Your house is on a street that's off a street that's off a street. And he just talks about, like, the mundanity of that, you know, the way things spiral from each other and are interrelated and rooted. It almost felt like a zooming in or zooming out. And to find a dictionary that's outdated, you know, how many words in there are no longer used? You know, never mind the fact that it doesn't contain a lot of modern language at all. What language does it contain that, you know, doesn't matter anymore? You know, and then you go to, like, the Epic of Gilgamesh, and how many times has that been translated? How many times has that been rewritten or reinterpreted or republished? And how much has it changed over all these years? And then to go back into that chaotic mind setting where things get mushed again, because now you're dealing with the translation of the narrator, where you've got the Epic of Gilgamesh now about what would Gilgamesh read, you know, would he put things in the context of Imhotep? Or would, you know, then zooming future, you talk about Robin Hood and just all of these instantaneous things. And then again, you're brought straight to the modern again about Instagram and watching, like, you know, of the president basically dubbed over and made to say words he never said. It's interesting how it contextualizes, you know, translation in a mind and in language and in publication, and then even in, like, manipulation. So I really liked this piece. I thought it was really well done. Thank you, Daniel. What did you think, Dan?
I did. Yeah, this is excellent. I enjoyed it very much. What a fun title. You know, a great takeoff of the subject. As you were saying, of how there can be miscommunication or mistranslation because of the little nuances. You know, every part was just amazing and a great take on that idea of how we try to pass along a thought and share an idea, but you know, kind of gets twisted. You know, I really like the humor. I know it was a serious write, but it also had humor in it. With there is a dictionary from 1830 missing all the words on my cell phone and without the word cell phone in it. That part had me smiling. I like how you know, he brings in some of the classic books, as you were mentioning, you know, the Gilgamesh being, you know, translated numerous times, and how often through each translation is something lost. I can very much relate to that part that in a town off of highway exit, less noticeable than the trees that surround it, on a street, off a street, off a street. You know, because that's basically how I give directions to people. In fact, most of the time I just tell people that I can't give directions. And if a stranger stops, like if I'm walking in the town I live in and a stranger pulls over and says, hey, can you tell me how to get here? I actually lie to the stranger and tell them I don't live here. So, because it's easier to say that. than to admit I don't know my way around a town that I live in.
I'm a very visual driver, and so I'm the kind that's going to give you those horrible directions. They're like, turn left at the white house with the big shrub. Like, but I've never looked at the street sign. You know, like, I grew up here. I don't know what street that is.
Yep, exactly. But this is definitely a great write by Daniel Descino. I thought it was very well done.
Just a random afterthought, you know, where he says, the dictionary from 1830, missing all the words on my cell phone and without the word cell phone in it, is interesting because it probably does have the word cell and it probably has the word phone in it, but they're not going to come together to mean anything close to
right
a cell phone.
Yeah, it might not even have the word phone in it. When did Alexander Graham Bell invent the phone? Well, I suppose it might.
Right, but that's the telephone. And phone it.
Oh, that's true. Phone would have. Yeah, you're right. That is interesting. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, that is an interesting afterthought because it would have had both words, but not the two of them put together as one word. Huh.
No.
Very cool.
No, and there's no way the meanings of either of those would have any semblance to the device we're speaking through.
Right.
I love the piece. I am perplexed by the title. Purple Monkey Dishwasher. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. Well, he said something in his AN about it. He said it was about, like, remember the game Telephone? Did he say in his AN about it? He says, I whisper something in one person's ear. Oh, yeah, based on the game of telephone tag, I whisper something in one person to ear, and it goes through 10 people, and by the time it whispers back in my ear, the person says to me, purple monkey dishwasher.
Nice. That makes sense. I didn't read that. That's great. Thank you, Daniel. Where are we off to?
All right. Up next, we have Long Time No See, My Friend by Vamped Vixen. And go ahead, Babbler.
All righty. Let me just refresh because it hasn't pulled up. There it is. Long Time No See, My Friend by Vamped Vixen. I remember I'm a poet under the pink cherry blossoms. The night spent under the lonely moon, when the phone is too heavy to call you, when I ache to rediscover myself, feel the beat of this heart within. Then I do dig into my threadbare bag, shaking dust from this dried-out pen, like a friend I only turn to when the rest of the weary world is silent and no one else will dine with me. My leather journal opens with a crack, like yoga for an elder spine, and I find my voice inside its walls. The scream is buried in my lungs. Times when I said yes instead of no, and all the words I never sent you. This paper incinerates the pain, poetry and I strolling roses in December, and all the places I would ever wish to be. And before we're done with our date, I promise there will be another, no matter how long the waiting takes.
Beautiful read there, Babbler. Wow, you know, I'm always impressed by Vamped Vixen's writing. There's such a sentimental and delicate and emotive quality to this write. And, you know, I think it's something we can all kind of relate to in the idea of memories of the past and people and places that we miss, you know, and the idea of keeping a journal, you know, and I really like that particular stanza, the third stanza. My leather journal opens with a crack like yoga for an elder spine, and I find my voice inside its walls, the screams buried in my lungs, times when I said yes instead of no, and all the words, I never sent you. And that is so true. It's oftentimes the regrets we have are the words that we never wrote or the words that we never spoke. And I also really like where it says, this paper incinerates the pain, poetry, and I strolling roses in December and all the places I would ever wish to be. And I like how that speaks on that oftentimes poetry is very cathartic. It helps us heal from that pain of the past. So excellent writing, very well done.
Yeah, cathartic is what came to my mind too, because that's how I feel when I write. And those pieces so relatable for me, you know. You know, when I remember, oh yeah, I can write things, you know, or oh, I have something to write or something I want to say. And then every time I start at it, I'm like, why did I stop? Why did it take so long for me to come back to this? You know, and there's never like a really good answer for that. Because I enjoy it so much. I just don't know why. So I find this really, really relatable. It feels really sincere, you know. And I also love just how detailed the moment is, you know, under the pink cherry blossoms. You don't really want to make a phone call and you just want to express yourself with just having an upwelling of feeling. And the detail of digging through a bag and shaking out a pen and opening this book that you haven't opened in a while and just kind of cracks open and you start to write and you remember how much you love it or how it makes you feel. And I just found this very much something that I go through. You know, I tried to, for so long as a teenager to like keep a journal. And there would be like these huge gaps. I'd write like 3 or 4 days and then all of a sudden I wouldn't come back. And then I'm like, hey, it's 8 months later. I'm just bad at that. But this is so beautiful. It feels really nostalgic and sincere, and I think expresses well like that catharsis of writing. I also love the way that it relates to the prompt. You know, frosted by stiff ice, my writing brush cannot begin to draw you a picture of my feelings. So it flows not, continue to write, your pain will float away like frost and ice on the water. Clearly relates to Murasaki's piece. And I think it's a wonderful translation of the message there. You know, it's almost as if she did indeed continue writing, and so her pain floated away. So I love in that way that it's a continuity of the prompt. I really liked it, Dan Dixon. Thank you so much for the write. What do we have up next?
What's that?
I said, what do we have up next?
Oh, we have Mirabilis by Millie Varumir. And I do apologize if I mispronounced that name at all. And it goes like this. Wild waters, mirage carrying the fears of yesteryear in a heart impaled, shimmers what is not said or what we don't admit. Like the love that I drew to keep you in memory, illusory mounted peace, try to disguise transcendent friendship, sweet devotion into romance, as you wished so hardly to keep the veil of the embellished lie. You didn't notice the tragedy, I sank before your eyes without you reaching me, too lost in your whimsical stories and poem.
Oh, I like the language of this, right? It's romantic, yet sad. You know, mirage carrying the fears of yesteryear in a heart impaled. Shimmers what is not said or what we won't admit, like the love that I drew to keep you in memory. You know, to reminisce back on things that didn't go well, you know, but to still kind of carry them. Not even necessarily as a bad memory, but just one of those of kind of wistful youth is kind of how I'm reading it. You know, to like someone that was a friend and try to turn that into a romantic relationship that gets robust, you know, that's one-sided. Now, as you wish so hardly to keep the veil of this embellished lie, you didn't notice the tragedy. I sank before your eyes without you reaching me, too lost in your whimsical stories. You know, to really enjoy someone's company and enjoy their sense of humor and to have feelings for them and try to, you know, move that relationship into something romantic and just kind of be rebuffed. But it sounds like at least kindly, you know, they just want to keep it friendly. And maybe they didn't notice, or maybe they didn't know how to comment on it. You know, I've certainly rebuffed people in my youth, and it's not that I didn't know, it's that I didn't know what to say. You know, if I don't return the feelings, what is there to say that isn't cruel? Especially when you value someone's friendship. But I really enjoyed this. It feels, I don't know, it feels like a reminiscing on kind of a bittersweet memory, you know, something that you both hold dear and holds pain, parcel with each other. So, wonderful, right, Mileva. What did you think, Pam?
I really like this, but I did notice after I got done reading the poem that she actually has her name as Mileva Rumor. I always have trouble personally, and it's nobody's fault, but just the way my brain works, is that when names or words are ran together, figuring out where the separation should be. But this is absolutely a beautiful, beautiful write. Wonderful imagery and metaphors. Another one that has a nostalgic feel to it. You know, I really like how it feels like, you know, looking back and feeling about like what pieces of your life are missing that you once had and they're no longer there. I really liked, especially near the end, you didn't notice the tragedy, I think, before your eyes without you reaching me, too lost in your whimsical stories. It feels like the idea of somebody who's so caught up in themselves that they don't notice their partner is going through a difficult time with depression. Or something similar to that. So just an amazing write and very well done.
Yeah, I like that perspective, Pam, of, you know, one person of being too caught up, you know, and kind of writing your own story about what's happening while someone's suffering. I enjoy that interpretation. I didn't really see it that way when I read it, but now I kind of do, you know, one person being depressed and unhappy and wanting help and the other person just being like, everything is fine, and it not being so. I think that's a great take.
Right, exactly, yeah. It does, yeah, but I liked your take too. That's the wonderful thing about poetry, being able to, have different interpretations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the different perspectives or ways you can read things, just even on your own mindset, I think is fascinating. It's one of the things I really enjoy about poetry is, yeah, there's really not any wrong answers. So.
Absolutely.
Where are we off to?
All right. Up next, we have The Zen of You by Blue Leader One. And go ahead, Babbler, and give that a read, please.
All right, The Zen of You. Small finch will topple over and fall, fully frozen dead into an abyss, never having imagined itself as anything else. Meanwhile, on another part of the planet, you walk into a room completely full of shit. Name-dropping, self-aggrandizing, diva misanthrope, the best of everything, the hero of every story, a sycophant in every corner. Oh, how inflated you are, a holy, sacred person receiving their due worship. I know I could laugh right in your ear, and all you'd hear is flattery. So no, feed your ego. But for the sake of our common humanity, because the truly sacred in me recognizes the truly sacred in you, I will whisper a truth softly for you. You've always been, you always are, and always will be you. No matter where you go, it's still you. You can pretend all you want, it's still you. The illusion is that you're someone else. Only the insane or corrupt believe anything different. And no, I'm not talking about power or of bounds, because you're not bound by anything, and all the power you need, you already possess. If there is a prison, it is the one you create, any need you manufacture. You are whole. What do you think, Pam? You there? Did I lose you? Right, not sure where Pam's at, but I'll go ahead and give my opinion. I really enjoyed this write. I thought it took a really nice and kind of sharp turn where, you know, it starts, it's this kind of naturalistic tone. A small finch will topple over and fall, fully frozen dead into an abyss, never having imagined itself as anything else, you know. Animals, some of the animals, you know, you look at them and you're like, you ever wonder, like, what it's like to be something else? Do you look at other animals and go, oh, I wonder? They seem so contented and so complete, just being and living in this moment. And I find that so relatable. And then it zooms into this character that's just like, you walk into a room completely full of shit. It suddenly takes on this, like, sardonic tone and this humor as well, you know. This bird is just so content with being itself. Even if it just, like, freezes to death and falls off a branch, it was never unhappy for even a moment. And yet, you don't even know how to be yourself. You paint yourself constantly to be this, the you of this piece, obviously not you, the listener, to be like this larger than life character, you know, that everybody loves you and you're so great and flawless and perfect, and you have these ridiculous stories that just, like, no one's really buying. I think everybody's met somebody like that, one of those, like, weird, compulsive, over the top liars, you know. And yet, you know, they could, you know, they want to point it out, like they could laugh in your ear, but they're not going to do that. Because even if they did that, you'd find a way to make that into a, you know, a positive thing for yourself. So, instead they've decided to be like this larger person, and just be like, you know, you're you, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, you shouldn't spend all your time and effort painting yourself to be better than you are, because there's nothing better than you are. You were created whole and complete in your current status. I love the pacing of this. I love the line breaks. I feel like there's several little pieces in here that could almost be like little mantras of their own. You know, you could take that first stanza about the finch, and that would stand on its own. But you could also take little bits of this. You know I could laugh right in your ear, and all you hear is flattery, is almost its own little piece itself. And then the you've always been, you always are, and you always will be, you also feels like its own little piece. I like this. I like that it has so many little bits that you could put together and pick up and kind of be, you know, read separately or as one. So I think it was wonderful, right? So thank you, Blue Leader One, for your right. All right. So let me, okay, looks like Pam is back, but I'll go ahead and I'll put the next one up. So, Pam, are you able to read this one?
Absolutely, absolutely. And did we put up the same poem or two different ones? Let's see.
I See Cloud of Despair by Janet Dates.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yes, yes.
Okay.
All right. Cloud of Despair by Damn It Dave. What is this cloud that rains despair on me? Why is the sky azure except for this? It seems the gods ensure my misery. My path to happiness has gone amiss. Where is the sun that used to shine so bright? Where are the bluebirds with a lilting tune? My heart has been enveloped by the night, and I must take my solace in the moon. Where are the friends who said they'd never leave? I watched as all my family disappeared. Seems loneliness is all I shall achieve, as I've been branded lunatic and weird. The gods have brought a plague upon my mind, and days without the rain are hard to find. End poem.
Wow, I really liked this sonnet. There's kind of like this overtone of like self-pity. It's a little wallowing, but I think that's, you know, the intention here. You know, that's the cloud of despair, right? What is this cloud that rains despair upon me? Why is the sky azure except for this? You know, why does it seem to be happier everywhere except where I am? You know, why does everything seem like sunshine and roses and then I'm getting pissed on? I think everyone's kind of felt that way at one point. Maybe, hopefully not, but I think so. You know, and what happened to better days? You know, where is the sun that used to shine so bright? And where are the bluebirds with a lilting tune? And sometimes I think you don't really appreciate those things until they're gone. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, this is crappy. You know, the good things in life, where are they? You know, where are the friends who said they'd never leave? And all your family disappeared. I've branded lunatic and weird, you know, to just be going through this rough time and somewhat publicly, you know, just feel really tread on and abandoned. And then the gods brought a plague upon my mind, and days without the rain are hard to find. You know, it feels like depression. You know, it feels like, you know, I almost wonder as the reader, you know, how much of this is depression and how much of this is real, you know. But I, at least for me, when I am feeling depressed, is when I tend to feel abandoned. And it's not necessarily that I have been, it's just it feels that way. You know, I feel like nobody cares. I feel like I'm being insulted. I feel like people are judging me. But I don't really think that, you know, retrospectively, I don't feel like anything changed except for my outlook. So I really liked this. I thought this was a great dark sonnet. I do want to mention, too, that we changed context here. So this went on to the next conference that I had open, that the title of was frustration. So that was the essential theme for the rites for this contest. I was just having a really hard time when I put this up. You know, I kept getting, ever since I had COVID in July of last year, I just keep getting sick. So it's really frustrating. I can't sleep. I'm deep in work with 12-hour shifts and all out of shit to give by the time I shuffle through the door at night. So I've just not had a lot of motivation. I felt really frustrated and ground down. So that was the theme. There were a bunch of quotes left as prompts too, but we don't have a whole lot of time left. So I will read those on our next show. Anyway, I want to give Pam a second to give her input. What do you think about Dammit Dave's piece?
I like this. It's a beautifully written sonnet, a wonderful dark rite. I can definitely relate to the idea of depression and feeling like everybody hates you. But, you know, it also speaks on what it's like to be the black sheep of the family, you know, especially in that third stanza. Wonderful rhyme and flow, of course, beautiful imagery. And I also liked the imagery in where it says about the, it seems, why is the sky azure except for this? It seems the gods ensure my misery. My path to happiness has gone amiss. It feels like the taking that classic image of the person standing right underneath the rain cloud that's just following them around. And sometimes life does feel like that. You know, you have those times where it feels like that rain cloud is specifically following you around. So wonderful write by Dammit Dave, and very well done.
Yeah, great comment. And again, thanks, Dave, for the poem. I think that about brings us to the end of the show. Keep an eye out for more contests from myself and Faziana for upcoming shows. Thank you so much, Pam, for covering for Faziana, and thank you, Phil, for running things behind the scenes as well. Have a great weekend, everyone, and I will see you next week. Night.